Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Politically Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Chris McDaniel, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio in St. Louis,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And joining us from Jefferson City is
Marshall Griffin.
Marshall, thanks for joining us. Joe is
sailing on the Rhine or whatever river there is in Germany. So
she's somewhere better than we are. Because we are currently in rainy St. Louis.
It is
or rainy Jefferson City.
It is monsooning outside.
Rainy and stormy Jefferson City, unfortunately.
And Joe is laughing at us while she's on vacation.
And looking at castles, according to Twitter.
But we should have a good show, even though Joe's not here.
Yes.
We're going to get to a few topics. We're going to talk a little bit about 2014, what the marquee races are, and what some of the implications are going to be. We're going to get to Medicaid after that. What's been going on and if it's going to go anywhere. And we're also going to talk a little bit about the gun nullification bill. What were you going to say, Jason?
I was going to say, you might notice we don't have a guest. We are taking a brief hiatus from guests since we've had two straight weeks of two guests. We want to, like, inform you with our monotone / smooth, buttery voices as opposed to
we got to get to the news, yeah.
Got to get to
the news. We're our own guests, in other words.
Yes.
Yes.
So, but yes, 2014. I think
it's going to be it's going to be real hot, right? With that auditor's race, Jason. Don't you think it's going to be pretty contentious this
year?
Well,
I think the most the thing that people are going to be looking for in that race is whether the Libertarian candidate or the Constitution Party candidate gets more votes. I think that is the one thing to watch for that.
It's going to be neck and neck between those two.
Neck and neck for 10% of the vote right there.
If they get 10% of the vote, that's pretty good.
Well,
it might open up a chance for a write-in as well.
Maybe you, Marshall.
No.
But the reason I think we're joking about this is for the first time in decades, if not several centuries, the Democrats have not put up a candidate for state auditor. And, you know,
there was a Democratic candidate at the beginning,
Jay Swearengen of North Kansas City, but he dropped out.
Right.
And he's not running for re-election either. So I think he just might be leaving Missouri politics for the time being or running for something else. But, you know, I think it was always going to be an uphill climb to take on Schweik. He had a pretty substantial war chest, I think over $600,000 or $700,000 of cash on hand. There are Democrats out there who have substantial cash on hands, and I listed five of them in an article a few months ago. But the upshot is none of them want to take a chance against running against an incumbent statewide down ballot officer when their chances of winning are just not typically high. I've said this many times, but it is very difficult to defeat a down ballot statewide official. And obviously – It hasn't never happened because Schweik
that's how Schweik
won,
got into office. Yeah,
but it's rare because it's hard to like make argumentations against them, and it's hard.
Especially something like auditor, where most of the time it's not a very, you know, Schweik hasn't done anything controversial really that a Democrat could really rally against. It's the auditor's position.
It was tough. And I mean, even when he was running against Susan Monty in 2010, I mean, what was thrown against her was, you know, not as explosive as other races because these offices are serve in many ways a utilitarian role, and unless you really screw up and do something that is super controversial, I mean, the chances of you getting attacked for it for something that's going to cause you to lose re-election are generally pretty low. But I think that people like me who watch these types of things expected at least like what I call a sacrificial lamb candidate. Like somebody who would just file, would probably lose, but
would make him spend a significant amount of money.
You know, somebody.
Or at least some money.
But the fact that nobody has done it, nobody has filed against him, I just think, first of all, it takes away the only statewide race from being interesting or coverable. I mean, just to be greedy for a second as a journalist. But I think there are other implications for this as well.
Well, before we get into some of the implications from this, there was a Politico article talking about what this says about Missouri Democrats and what it says specifically about their bench. Did you see this?
I did, from my Mizzou classmate, Juana Summers. Yes.
So what did you think of that? Did you think that it resonated?
Well, I know that Democrats were mad about it. I saw on Twitter. And I think that they pointed out that, you know, Democrats have a two-term governor and a two-term treasurer and Jason Kander and all these people. But I do think it says something that, you know, the Democrats did have people who could run against Schweik and I think would have made him work for it. People like, you know, I didn't think that Clint Zweifel would get in, for example. I think that would probably be something that would be a little too risky for someone who's maybe looking at 2016. But the people that I listed, Scott Sifton of Afton, Darlene Green, the city of St. Louis comptroller, you know, John Wright, that state representative from Roachport who has self-funded almost $500,000 for a state rep race. Now, all those people would have been able to have the resources and be able to run credible campaigns, and they decided not to do it. So I don't know if that means they don't have a bench, but I do think it does say something about risk averseness.
Yeah,
I think that's what it says. The article that really kind of got my attention was Steve Kraske's Kansas City Star article that came out on Friday, and it was making the argument that by giving Schweik a pass, the Democrats are actually engaging in some sort of strategy to make Schweik stronger against Catherine Hanaway. And in actuality, it's a good thing for the Democrats. And I think that that argument has been made before. Joe actually mentioned it.
It was on our podcast.
And I think Joe actually asked Catherine Hanaway about it. And I liked the article, and I thought it was an interesting way of thinking. But I wanted to kind of bring a counter question to that. And just thinking about short term and this year, because there's been a big emphasis by Claire McCaskill and Chris Koster that they need to do better in the legislature. So how does it help Democratic efforts to get more Senate seats or more House seats if you leave somebody with $700,000 of cash on hand to either give money to other candidates or direct his fundraisers to give them money? Right. I mean, the argument has been put forth, well, maybe he'll save that money for, you know, 2016. But if he gives $200,000 of that away, he's going to be able to get that back pretty easily. Sam Fox has given him $100,000 donations several times. And I just think that for all the hullabaloo about Koster giving $200,000 to the House and Senate candidates, not only do you have Schweik, but you have all these state Senate candidates who were opposed in 2010 and, you know, 2012 were unopposed too. Brian Munzlinger, Bob Dixon, Dan Brown, all of them faced pretty reasonably competitive races in 2010. Two of them even beat incumbent Democrats completely unopposed. Those people are going to give money to candidates too. I just don't see how this is beneficial towards that goal. 2016 is another story, but again, If you're thinking short term, I'm not sure how this is good for the Democrats on any level. Marshall, what do you think about this?
Yeah, well, that does – it makes sense to me as well. Most of my in-depth studies and coverage are about what they're doing once they're in office as opposed to trying to get reelected or back into office. But I will tell you it at least makes it a little bit easier for them, especially Munzlinger and Dan Brown, to focus on their job at hand here, as opposed to having to, you know, divide their time between, you know, how are they going to raise money and how am I going to get this piece of legislation passed. At least it frees them up a little bit in that respect, and that's got to be good for, you know, at least the working relationship of elected Republicans here in Jefferson City.
And I want to mention why I mentioned Munzlinger and single him out in particular, because I have covered Missouri politics, not necessarily before, you know, Joe was born or whatever, but for about 8 years. And I remember a time when Northeast Missouri was still a Democratic stronghold. It was one of the last rural outposts of strength for the party. Now, flash forward 8 years, which is 2006 when Wes Schumacher beat Bob Bain in one of the most expensive state Senate races in history in Northeast Missouri. And you now have a relatively similar yet Republican-leaning more after redistricting, where the incumbent Republican doesn't even have an opponent. Some of the other Northeast Missouri reps don't have an opponent. And you have the possibility, if everything falls into place and that Ed Schieffer's seat goes Republican, of the Republicans having a complete, utter domination of that region. And if you're talking about building a party and building legislative strength, I just don't know how not putting a candidate against those people helps you. Maybe it conserves money for the races we're about to talk about, you know, Jeffco and St. Louis County. But I think it's just very risky. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading this wrong, but I just don't think strategically this is beneficial in the long run, or at least in the short term, maybe in the long run.
Well, let's talk about some of those Senate races and some of those House races that we're going to be looking forward to in 2014.
Yes.
One of those is the Shoup seat, where she has raised a significant amount of money with the help of Koster. But as you mentioned, Jason, a lot of that can be undone if, you know, there are a significant amount of Republicans who aren't facing challenges who can help out whoever the Republican nominee happens to be.
Now, I wrote about this race on Monday, and I want to make a couple of caveats here. First of all, we've had Jill Shoup on our show before, and I've said to her face, and I'll say her when she's not here, she's a very strong candidate for that seat. She has a history of winning elections against, you know, credible opponents. She's raised a pretty good amount of money, and the seat leans Democratic. So you got to give her due there, that she's going to have some inherent advantages there. And the other thing is, there's a three-way Republican primary, which probably doesn't help Republicans that much.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, because there are so many Republican senators who are either not running this cycle or who are unopposed this cycle, I actually added up their cash on hand, and it was around $1.8 million. And that doesn't include someone like Dave Schatz, who has raised $525,000, which includes loans. So he may not spend that money or give money to other people in just the last month. So that could mean that whoever wins that primary could just instantly have $500,000 immediately. And you see a situation with Jack Spooner, who's an attorney. He's not Jay Ashcroft, who's getting most of the attention. He's raised about $80,000 in the last week or two since he started a MEC committee. So, you know, that's, again, the sort of thing that would happen. But that's going to be a very competitive race. And I think even with a well-funded Republican, Shoup is going to have a lot going for her. And obviously the other one is what I like to call the battle for Jeffco, which is between Jeff Rorta and Paul Weiland. I picked that by default as the most competitive general election contest, which I think just says a lot about how just of a bust this election cycle is. Because going back to 2006, the 22nd district in Jefferson County, it was at the time held by a Republican, Bill Alter. And Ryan McKinnon ended up knocking him off pretty easily. It was kind of an assumed, you know, result that, you know, Republicans weren't going to win that seat. And now it's the most competitive seat in the entire election. I think it's not only a testament that Jefferson County is more competitive, but it's just that there's not much there, you know.
Yeah.
But we'll still be covering it because we're bored, I guess. So.
Well, that's led a lot of people to say that what the marquee and what the important issues are going to be are actually ballot initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to have to talk about that another week, but that's definitely something to keep your eye on. And that's something where we'll have a better idea of what the ballot initiatives are in the weeks to come.
Yes, I've already yammered on too long about candidates, so
well,
don't want to bore people to death. So,
well, let's get to something else. Medicaid. Marshall, what's going on with Medicaid expansion, Medicaid reform, where you're reporting?
There is a little bit of a push to come up with a Medicaid expansion / reform package that Republicans might be able to accept. That's the goal. That's the objective.
Is this Ryan
Silvey's
approach?
Behind these particular bills.
Is this Ryan Silvey's?
Yes, we are. Yeah, Ryan Silvey's, he came out with a bill that he has not been filed yet because the deadline for filing new legislation has already passed in the Senate. So the only way that this could get onto a bill is by amendment, and that's what he is considering at this point. I actually talked to Senator Silvey about a few minutes ago regarding his bill. What you were going to ask something?
Yeah, tell me a little bit about the bill. What would it be like?
Basically, it would combine. It would raise Medicaid to 138%, not the 100% that Representative Jay Barnes' bill would have done last year. Senator Silvey's bill would go up to 138%. It would combine free market reforms, also making use of the federal exchange to provide some coverage, and with the goal of doing some type of reform, or excuse me, some type of expansion that would bring about reforms and what's been touted as a Missouri solution or a Missouri solution,
a Missouri
depending
solution.
On who's doing the talking. Senator Silvey put out an op-ed piece recently where he said we can't just keep saying no to expanding Medicaid without coming up with some type of alternative, without some type of reform package. We can't just continue to say no and do nothing else. And so this is his answer to what he hopes can be done. It is somewhat similar to what Noel Torpy. Is sponsoring in the House.
Jason and I talked a little bit about this before we got on air, and perhaps unsurprisingly, Silvey's bill, or I guess we can't call it a bill yet, or his ideas are already facing some struggles, particularly from some of the conservative members of the party. Jason, is there any conceivable way that it could happen this session?
This session, probably not.
Eventually,
possibly. And
yeah,
I think that something like what Silvey and Torpy are proposing will be part of the solution. I don't think that the Republicans are going to take up a Medicaid expansion that Nixon wants or what Democrats want and pass it. I think their chances of that are zero.
Yeah.
I do think, though, that they would potentially pass a quote-unquote transformation or reform bill, which is essentially expansion but just making a whole bunch of changes to Medicaid. I mean, let's just cut the gibberish there. That's what it is. It's still kind of bringing the same goal but just making a lot of changes to how the program works. But I don't think – and I've said this so many times that people are probably sick of me saying this, but I don't think alone that could really help.
Yeah.
I really think that the best way for them to go forward is – first of all, there are going to be Republicans that are going to filibuster this no matter what, and they're going to be inconsolable. So you're going to, have one or two of those left before that comes around. So you might have to wait for John Lamping and Brad Lager to leave the Senate and be replaced by other people.
Yeah.
And then there's still obstacles. You still have people who are going to be there next year. Ed Emery's still going to be there. Dan Brown, who has no Democratic opponent, as I mentioned, he said he would filibuster this. And I'm sure there will be others as well. And obviously, and there's Rob Schaff.
Yes.
And he's probably the most ardent and able filibuster-er of all. And I mean, he is facing a contested election. I wouldn't say that he's necessarily a shoo-in for reelection because that area is not super Republican, but he has never won. He has always won his elections by at least like 55% or above. And that includes his Senate race in 2010, which signals to me that the chances of him not winning his election are very low. I think he is favored for reelection. So what I wrote a few weeks ago and what I've been saying on this show and other shows is he has specific ideas about, access, transparency, and just the way hospitals are regulated and confirmed. And I think that the only way that a bill like Silvey or Torpy's bill is going to be successful is you have to work with him and you have to incorporate a lot or most of his ideas into any of those bills. And even that I don't think is a sure thing. And I want to just be clear. I don't think that that would make Rob Schaff support that, and it wouldn't mean that he supports Medicaid expansion. But there is a possibility, as he told me, that if he does an analysis and all the numbers kind of work out to where it isn't expensive in his eyes, he may stand down from filibustering.
Right.
I want to be super clear on this. I don't want to convey the message that he is for Medicaid expansion if some of these things happen. He is absolutely opposed to it. And I think if you don't work with him, he's going to be a very potent obstacle. So my question for like the Missouri Hospital Association and the Chamber of Commerce is it worse for hospitals to shut down when nothing happens? Or is it worse if you have a Medicaid transformation or reform bill that makes significant changes to certificate of need or price transparency? And I think in 2015, 2016, that I think will become an issue. This year, I just don't see it.
So. I think that gets back to what we've been saying for a while, which is that Medicaid transformation is a real long shot this session.
Would you say so?
Because we haven't reached any consequences yet. Yeah. We haven't seen rural hospitals shut down. But I think once those things start happening, I think that that'll definitely be a big incentive. What do you think, Marshall?
I agree. And also getting back to the election cycle, even though candidate filing has stopped, there will still be people who will run for reelection or run for higher office on the Republican side who will use their opposition to Medicaid expansion as something that they can campaign on.
Sure.
And because this is an election year, I don't see much happening with Medicaid expansion, even with the proposals being sponsored by Representative Torpy and Senator Silvey. Even Senator Silvey told me this afternoon he even acknowledges that his newly crafted proposal is a long shot.
Yes, but it'll still be an issue, and it will still have an impact. I think we're just kind of talking about the real legislative mechanics here.
So let's get to a bill that does stand a good chance of becoming law, or I shouldn't say becoming law, but of passing. Marshall?
Yes, passing but not becoming law.
Yes, yes. So this is Senator Nieves' last year in the Senate.
He's going to run for Recorder of Deeds of Franklin County.
But this is kind of his last hurrah. Tell us a little bit about the bill, Marshall.
Well, actually, I'm going to tell you about his bill, and I'm going to tell you about Representative Funderburk's bill,
yeah.
which also got some attention this week. The House actually perfected their version of the Second Amendment Preservation Act. That's the one that's sponsored by Representative Funderburk.
You might know it as the gun nullification bill.
The gun, yes, the gun, as I call it, the gun control nullification bill, because it would not nullify
guns. It doesn't nullify guns, yeah.
I think the Democrats would actually like it if it nullified guns.
That's a fair point.
In addition to it being Senator Nieves' last year, this is also Representative Funderburk's last year.
And he is running for St. Charles County Executive against Steve Ellman, by the way.
Interesting, yeah. Funderburk is term limited out, so this will be his last hurrah as far as getting a major bill out. And at this point, I don't think the Republicans care a whole lot which version of the bill passes. But I should mention that the House version now has something significant as far as backing away from, I guess, what some would consider a very extremist move. Instead of mandating a Class A misdemeanor for federal officers who would enforce federal gun laws, that's out of the House bill. Now it would just make them liable to being sued as opposed to actually being thrown in jail or fined, so which I suppose could actually be even more expensive than paying a $1,000 fine.
And so you've talked about the Class A misdemeanor, which, of course, that was in the bill that was passed last year, which the governor vetoed. I don't remember the vote count during veto session. How short were they? Does anybody remember off the top of their head?
Well, it passed in the House by, I think, the exact margin. I think it was 109.
Yes,
and then
it was.
It failed in the Senate by, I believe, one vote.
One vote or two votes? Well, there were only two no votes among the Republicans, and it was the top two, Dempsey and Richard, which one pushed it over the – or kept it from being overridden, I'm not sure.
I think it was Dempsey because Richard had already announced that he wasn't going to vote for it. So,
right.
So, Marshall, is there any indication that this changing it from misdemeanor to just something that you can be sued for, is that something that there's any indication that either of those two Republicans would change their mind as a result of those changes?
I've not heard yet whether or not that would tip the balance as far as a potential override in September. But I'm guessing that that's what the thought was, that maybe this will make it a little bit easier to digest if it does come down to a veto override. But at the same time, maybe a majority of the House members might decide just to pass the Senate version, which is Senator Nieves's bill, which still has the Class A misdemeanor language for against federal officers.
This is going to court, though, right, Marshall?
Oh yes, whichever version gets out, it will go to court. It will go to court,
And will likely be thrown out based on the supremacy clause, because it's nullifying.
And that would only happen if a veto override were successful,
right?
And it actually did become law.
What do you I think often sometimes people accuse Republicans of passing gun and abortion bills in election seasons to gin up support or whatever, but do you see this like actually helping anybody or hurting anybody? Because, I mean, in the three state Senate races that I would consider competitive that are open seats, the 10th district between Ed Schieffer and Jeannie Riddle, and then Rorta versus Whelan, I think that they all support the concept of all of this. It just doesn't seem like if this is a way of trying to needle Democrats, it seems like it's going to work very well. Or do you think it's more of just people are passing this because they believe in it at this point?
Absolutely. I think that's totally it, because it was pushed so hard and so strong last year in a non-election year. And this year they're trying to come up with a version that they think will become law, regardless of whether it gets vetoed. They're working really hard to actually make this a law, as opposed to championing something they know won't pass just to make themselves look good at the ballot box. Now, I do think that does come into play somewhat, but keep in mind also that there were, I believe, 8 Democrats. I have to look through my Twitter feed real quick, but I do believe there were 8 Democrats that voted for this as well, and I do believe Jeff Rorta was one of them that voted yes. Mm-hmm. On this, but don't hold me to that until
I
can.
Yeah, and I don't know if Schieffer or Rorta voted on that. I know that I believe they voted yes on it during the regular session, and I don't remember how they voted during veto session.
But yeah, I do have this in front of me right now, and I'm looking down the list here, and Rorta actually did vote yes for the Second Amendment Preservation Act, at least for the perfection of it yesterday.
Oh.
He did actually – he was one of the I believe about 8 Democrats that voted yes.
And just as an aside in that race, since it is the de facto number one race, it struck me that both of those candidates are trying to like match each other on some of these hot button issues. So on guns, they both are for something like this. But on unions, Paul Whelan, who is a Republican, has voted against paycheck protection, and I don't think there's been a vote on right to work, but I know that he's not for that. So for such a high profile race, it does seem like both of those candidates have a lot of similarities, and which is why I think that race is going to come down to personalities, and it's going to be pretty heated and ugly from my prediction, because they've already run against each other in a House race and there's some bad blood there. So, but that's an aside, so continue.
All right. Well, Marshall, I know you have stories to get out and cover, so I think we'll have to cut it off there. But to close this out here, you can read all 3 of our stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CSMcDaniel. Jason, you can be followed on Twitter.
Jay Rosenbaum.
Marshall, you can be followed on Twitter.
@ Marshall G. Report.
Marshall, thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Until then, so long.
So long.